Coming up on the program today, drugs and the pricing thereof, solar power and the pricing thereof, and Netflix. Nothing about prices there. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 23rd of February. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. Yeah, the Nevada caucuses. The Republicans there, sure, we could talk about that. The markets, another grim day. Yeah, we could talk about that, too. What say, though, that we don't go to the dark side today? How about that? How about some news that might bring a little cheer, especially if you're a health policy type? The unit of CVS, the big drugstore chain that manages prescription drug benefits for health insurance companies, said today that it has managed to buck, or at least moderate, the distressing trend of rising prescription drug costs in this country, bringing price inflation last year down to a relatively not-so-terrible 5%. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains how the company did it.
CVS Caremark was able to tame price inflation for drugs because of two things.
It's based on their negotiating power, and it's based on availability of therapeutic substitutes.
Eric Gordon is a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. He says groups like CVS and rival Express Scripts are huge.
About half the prescriptions in the U.S. go through them. So they have a lot of bargaining power, a lot of influence over drug pricing.
CVS can play generics, name brands, and competitors generally off of one another by refusing to cover a drug or cover it less.
They have been able to limit and exclude probably twice as many drugs as they did 2 years ago.
Robert Goldberg is co-founder of the Center for Medicine in the Public Interest, a group that does receive funding from pharmaceutical producers. He says how prescription coverage is decided and who gets the savings is opaque.
It doesn't always directly pass through to the consumers.
The best way to evaluate how CVS and pharmaceutical benefit managers are reducing prices may be to look at it from the consumer's point of view. Dan Mendelson is president of consulting firm Avalier Health.
If cost reductions are happening because people are not able to access medications they need, that's a bad thing.
If, on the other hand, he says, drug costs are falling because the most efficient drug is being purchased, great. He argues that balance is something consumers and health plans have to keep constant tabs on. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
If you were paying attention while we did the numbers yesterday, as I know you always do, remind me to tell you about my theory on the numbers, by the way. But if you were paying attention, you heard me talking about Bank of America and how they've got a new mortgage they're offering to low-income borrowers, just 3% down. What could possibly go wrong, I hear you ask? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer went to find out.
First of all, these aren't the liar loans of the housing crisis where consumers didn't have to document their income to get a loan. Bank of America says it'll turn itself inside out to be sure these low-income borrowers don't default.
We're going to hold people's hands as they go through the process.
That's Terry Francisco, a Bank of America spokesman. He says these borrowers will be thoroughly vetted. They will be low income, but they have to have a credit score of at least 660. And Francisco says there's mandatory counseling for first-time home buyers.
And we want to make sure their eyes are wide open as they walk through the process. So this is not anything related to things that were done in the past.
In 2014, Bank of America reached a $16 billion settlement with the Justice Department. Justice said the bank, quote, conceded that it originated risky mortgage loans leading up to the financial crisis. Morris Davis teaches real estate finance at Rutgers University. He says Bank of America could be trying to repair its image with these new loans.
In doing so, you could say maybe they're losing the least with these loans and repairing their image at the same time.
Because these borrowers are a good risk. They may be low income, but they have a track record of paying their bills. Guy Sakala is publisher of Inside Mortgage Finance. He says Bank of America may be starting a trend.
Wells Fargo, Chase, other banks could do similar programs to this if they wanted to.
Sakala says big banks have had programs for low and moderate income borrowers before, but they've just been small niches of the mortgage market. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Oil down today, a lot. Equities down today, also a lot. Not much else to say, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I mentioned crude prices were down today, down a lot to, as I said, 4% or more. That's going to do nothing at all to cure the economic ills in Venezuela, where falling oil, rising inflation, and a legacy of economic mismanagement are all coming home to roost. Marketplace's Scott Tong has been in Venezuela the past week or so, Maracaibo today, so we got him on the phone to tell us what it's like down there in that economy. Hey, Scott.
Hey, Kai.
So I want to touch base, first of all, on this inflation news. The official inflation rate, I looked it up, is 186%. What does that look like on the ground?
Well, that rate is the official rate that the government is giving. There are other independent estimates. One projection by the IMF is that it could reach 700% this year. Oh. I mean, one thing that is really driving prices crazy upward is the black market here. Venezuela imports just about every consumer good. And so they have to buy these with U.S. dollars on the international market. The problem is they don't sell enough oil right now at a high enough price to have enough of these dollars, these petrodollars. So there's a shortage and there's desperation on the streets all across the country. And this morning I visited a physical black market here in Maracaibo City.
Well, what is it? I mean, were you like down an alley and around a corner and some guy went, "Psst, hey, kid, come here"? I mean, what does it look like?
It was way out in the open.
Huh.
On the outside, they were selling fruit and vegetables, plantains, just a regular market. And you go in and you see the illegally sold packaged stuff. A small pack of diapers, Pampers, is 11 times the regulated price. Corn flour, the most basic staple, 20x. Birth control pills, 13x. And baby formula, 13 times the regular price. And one thing we couldn't find at all, that's mosquito repellent. They have a Zika virus outbreak here and we couldn't even find it on the black market.
So, there's not enough of anything, right? But is this just oil and petroleum, or is it, where does this come from?
These shortages began before the oil bust. One thing that's been going on here for years is domestic production of everything has plummeted. So I went out this afternoon and visited a cattle ranch here in western Venezuela, and they say it's so hard to make money out here. The government, that is the Socialist Party, is in control of the government here. It has been confiscating the people's land for the past decade. All the inputs are imported for the ranchers, so machinery, fertilizer, feed. You can't either can't get them or the prices are black market sky high. And then you can't pass along any of these costs to the consumer because of the price control. So it gives you an idea of how hard it is to run a basic business and produce things domestically in Venezuela.
Yeah, it sounds, though, Scott, like it's just layers and layers of catastrophe.
Layers that are hard to understand and hard to untangle. I spoke to a pollster and consultant. His name is Luis Vicente León in Caracas, and he describes it as simply as two diseases. First, you have the government intrusion into the market, and that's like you have dengue fever. And on top of that, you have the Zika virus, which is the oil bust.
We are mixing two different illnesses right now. The illness coming from the intervention and the impact of the oil market. Both of them impacting the economy. Of course, the situation in Venezuela become worse and worse and worse. And the most dramatic thing is that the government didn't decide to change the strategy.
And finally, Kai, this gets to what the government is doing here. They just announced a gasoline price hike to try to get their fiscal house in order. They need revenue to import stuff. They need money to pay off their creditors, or else they could default on their debt this year. But the people I talked to, they pretty much yawned at the gas hike. And Venezuela still has perhaps the cheapest gas in the world. And even with this higher price, if you fill up with typical 91-octane gas, you can fill two whole tanks for the price of a bottle of water.
Marketplace's Scott Tong on the ground in Maracaibo, Venezuela, for us. Scott, thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's been a good couple of years for solar energy companies. Not for the folks who actually make the panels that go on your roof. That's been a mess, thanks to tumbling profit margins. But for companies that get you in the solar game, cheaper panels and federal rebates have made it all kinds of attractive. But conventional utilities, losing customers, are fighting back. From Las Vegas, Adam Burke has that story.
It's a cloudless morning, and two backyard energy moguls are surveying their tiny empires.
Yeah, I'm making 5.94.
Oh, you just went to 5?
Yeah, well, I'm almost at 6 already.
Yeah, see, I'm at 1.1.
1.1 is in kilowatt hours. These guys are small-time solar producers, so we're talking kilowatts, not megawatts. We're also talking greenback dollar bills.
Okay, I saved, according to this, $2,813.
Say hello to Richard Stewart.
Dollars saved.
And Dale Matz.
We're like, okay, how much are we making? How much are we saving?
These guys love to get together in Stewart's backyard, each in front of a laptop, to check out whose solar panels are putting out more juice.
Want me to show you my $14 power bill? Boom.
When it comes to rooftop solar, Nevada had the fastest growth in the U.S. in 2015. The state saw a new customer sign up every 40 minutes on average. And at the heart of that growth is a pitch from solar companies, utilities, and elected officials. Put panels on your roof, and you'll save money by buying less electricity. And if you have extra, the utility will buy it for the same price you pay for its power.
My power and Dale's excess power goes right to my neighbor, and it gets used instantly by them, and they're billed for it.
If you buy panels, you can pay yourself back quickly. If you sign a lease agreement with a company like SolarCity, the company will put panels on your roof, and you'll save on your electric bill without putting up a single dollar. And what made it all work in Nevada was that dollar-for-dollar exchange called net metering.
Net metering is really the magic of how solar benefits a customer.
Here's a consumer education video made by NV Energy, Nevada's largest utility.
We are allowed to take care of customers by giving you 1 kilowatt hour for every kilowatt hour you give us. It's a one-for-one trade, which is really great. You're essentially giving it to us at retail value.
The company posted that sunny video on YouTube in the summer of 2015. But even as the utility evangelized to customers about the virtues of net metering, NV Energy was pushing for changes that would cripple the rooftop solar industry. In December, the Nevada Public Utilities Commission eliminated one-for-one net metering for residential solar customers. Over several years, the rate NV Energy pays solar customers for their surplus energy will be cut by 75%. There went the business model for rooftop solar.
People, that is un-American!
This month, more than 1,000 angry consumers and industry workers demonstrated outside the PUC's Las Vegas offices. But the noise outside did not stop the agency from reaffirming a controversial part of its decision. The net metering rules won't just apply to new solar customers, but the 17,000 customers who have already purchased or leased panels. What seemed like a wise investment last year has turned out to be an expensive mistake.
You cannot pull a bait and switch like that. We're not gonna take it!
NV Energy did not respond to requests for comment, and the PUC's Director of Regulatory Operations, Anne Marie Cuneo, wouldn't talk either. But on a local public television program, Cuneo said residential solar customers were being subsidized by non-solar customers.
The commission has always been very clear that the rates can change. The utility has been very clear that the rates can change. The legislation was clear that the rates can change.
Come on, that's misleading. No one would go solar in their right mind if a new net metering was going to go away.
Lyndon Rive is the CEO of SolarCity, a company that finances and installs residential solar systems in 18 other states. It shut down sales in Nevada and laid off 500 employees after the PUC's decision in December. Rive and other industry leaders are gathering signatures for a ballot referendum that he says would allow the industry to come back.
I don't think people quite understand it. This decision has decimated the entire industry. There is no more rooftop industry in Nevada.
The residential solar industry's share of the energy market in the U.S. is tiny. Still, rooftop solar has grown year over year, nibbling away at the margins of utility profits.
In the long term, rooftop solar is a pretty disruptive threat to the utility business model.
Corey Honeyman is an analyst at GTM Research, a solar energy market research firm. He points out Nevada is unusual. Most other states have protected existing solar customers from rate changes like this. But he also says Nevada shows how utilities are learning to protect their profits from rooftop solar.
What happened in Nevada was very much unprecedented, and it should be a wake-up call for everyone in the industry to understand the risk and likelihood of this happening again.
So how much is net metering worth to a homeowner? Well, Richard Stewart, that guy with a laptop in his backyard, paid a little more than $30,000 for his solar array. But with the PUC's change in rates, he'll get back only half his money in 20 years.
This was a dollar and cent decision for me based on the rules at the time. If I'd known that they were going to do this, I wouldn't have invested.
And that's the rooftop solar industry's fear. If customers can't count on savings, the business model is, well, no business model at all. In Las Vegas, I'm Adam Burke for Marketplace.
Coming up.
What they want us to do is feel like we can't live without Netflix. It's FOMO, fear of missing out.
Because YOLO. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 188 points today, 1.1%, ended things at 16,431. The NASDAQ down 67 points, 1.4%, 4503 at the bell. The S&P 500 declined 24 points, about 1.25%, closed at 1921. Sales of existing homes rose 0.4% last month, the National Association of Realtors said today. But that report also shows a shortage of available houses. Home Depot reported strong sales and earnings today, stock up 1.3%. Analysts expect Lowe's is also going to benefit from the strong housing market when it reports tomorrow. Lowe's, nonetheless, down 0.2% in advance of that number today. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 1.71%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know how electronic medical records are the holy grail of medical modernization in this country? Try robots. There are 27 robots running around a hospital in San Francisco right now. Picture R2-D2 lookalikes zooming through the hallways, giving the hospital what I imagine is a futuristic kind of vibe. Not everybody loves them, though. Jenny Gold from Kaiser Health News dropped by to have a look.
Picture the tugs as little flatbed trucks, ferrying carts of stuff around the vast new UC San Francisco hospital complex. Food, linens, medications, medical waste, you name it. And they do it more efficiently than humans.
Yeah, so this one is going up to one of the floors. It is carrying meals that were ordered probably in the past 20 minutes.
Dan Henroyd is in charge of this elite fleet. He says each tug travels about 35 miles every day. In the past year, they've made 157,000 trips through the hospital. He takes me down to the kitchen, where the tugs pick up trays of food and drop off dirty dishes.
In nutrition and food services, we named all of ours for fruit. So we have apple, pear, blueberry, orange, and grape.
They're kind of cute, but also a little unnerving as they shuttle around like they own the joint. Henroyd says they're carefully programmed to stay out of the way, but sometimes it feels as if one's about to mow you down. In a moment of bravery, I decided to step in a tug's path.
See, it stopped. Good 2 feet away from you. You thought I was going to run into you.
Fortunately, they have sensors along their base that can tell if something's in their way. The robots actually have very little contact with patients. Though, when the kids in the children's hospital catch a glance, unit coordinator Michael Eckenrode says it's quite a scene.
And when the robots come, the kids start screaming, "Robots!" And they follow them down the hall. And it goes down around the corner and opens the elevator and gets on by itself. So that's like a magic thing for them.
But not everyone is such a big fan.
I think they're helpful. I think that they're also kind of a pain.
Marty Thompson is a nurse in the neonatal intensive care unit.
I've seen them run into computers. I've seen them run into the glass doors. I've seen them run into each other.
She says the robots have gotten better, but for her, there's still the issue of jobs.
Definitely there are jobs lost, which is kind of interesting to me because, you know, with the economy the way that it is, you think people need jobs, and then we have these robots doing them.
Dan Henroyd says no one actually lost a job to the robots. UCSF was in the midst of a hiring spree for the new hospital anyway. The tugs allowed him to hire about 30 fewer workers than he would have otherwise. And he says the robots are really just carting things from one point to another. Human workers are there on either end to pick up the goods and interact with patients.
The tug has a job to do, and it's sort of a thankless job, and so I think better to have a robot doing it perhaps than a human.
Overall, the tug program has cost about $6 million, but Henroyd says they're actually saving the hospital money.
The cost of transporting material, supplies, waste is an overhead cost. So the more that you can do that efficiently, the less cost you have.
Over in the medical supplies room, we meet two more tugs. Colin Kahale loads one of them up with gauze and tubing.
I think 18 might be Willie McTuggy, and we have Tuggy McFresh.
Each tug knows 70 different phrases and can speak in a variety of accents, including Australian here at the elevator.
Waiting for clear lift.
Entering lift. Please stand aside.
With 120 hospitals throughout the U.S. already using tugs, before long, we might all find ourselves standing aside. In San Francisco, I'm Jenny Gold for Kaiser Health News and Marketplace.
Hey. There was a big fancy party in Washington, D.C. this week, the ceremonial premiere of the fourth season of House of Cards. It drops for mere mortals like you and me in a week or two, and come on, you know it's going to be all buzzy at the office, right? What's not going to be getting any buzz is what the show's ratings are. In fact, we don't get numbers for any of the offerings that Netflix provides, just because. Jason Mattel is a professor of film and media at Middlebury College in Vermont. He wrote about Netflix and its mystery numbers in The Atlantic today. Justin, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
The question has always been, why doesn't Netflix release its ratings? And you're basically positing here that we're asking the wrong question, right?
Yeah. Netflix is in a very different business model than broadcasters or cable television. Netflix doesn't sell ads. They are actually not even selling programs. They are selling subscriptions. So for subscribers, Netflix itself is the commodity.
They're selling buzz, basically, right? They're selling peer pressure. They're selling water cooler conversation. They're selling, oh, my God, did you see the new House of Cards?
Exactly. So what they want us to do is feel like we can't live without Netflix. It's FOMO, fear of missing out.
Huh. All right. So here's the thing. One has to assume that Netflix could release their numbers if they wanted to. They don't. It's a conscious choice. Are they manipulating us?
I wouldn't say they're manipulating us per se. I think what they're trying to do is to sell us a product. And again, the product is Netflix itself. And Netflix is working. I mean,
right,
subscriber
right, right.
numbers are growing really consistently and now globally.
Right. This drives regular broadcasters nuts. You point out in this piece that NBC spent a lot of time and money trying to figure out what Netflix's numbers are. You know, the head of FX basically said a couple of years ago, this is terrible.
Yeah. And it's I think a big part of it is a lot of traditional television companies feel like Netflix is competition, but they're not playing by the same rules. And it's true, they're not. But of course, they're not operating with the same profit margins and the same products itself. So I still think that broadcast television and even basic cable and some premium cable shows are far more popular than Netflix. And I think that these broadcasters want to be able to say that definitively.
Right. But you can imagine Reed Hastings at Netflix saying to traditional broadcasters when they complain about this, stop whining. Keep up.
Yeah. Hastings and Netflix itself is a tech company first. And I think for Netflix, one of their other main goals is to accumulate as much data as possible on its subscribers. Yeah. I mean, Netflix not only could release its ratings are far, far, far more accurate than what Nielsen provides. And I think that in some ways, if I were NBC, that would be my frustration, is I've spent decades wanting to know what viewers are doing. Netflix knows and won't tell us.
Okay, so prognosticate for me then. What can we, knowing what we think we know, about what Netflix knows, right? What can we tell about the future of Netflix in this environment?
My gut says that Netflix is not sustainable in the long term as a standalone streaming distributor. And they're really in this midpoint between technology firm and media firm. And most times if you try to merge these two industries, it doesn't work. So I think that this is the interesting point is, are they going to pivot toward a technology firm and merge with a company like Apple or Microsoft or the like? Or are they going to merge with a media firm and become, you know, a player in Hollywood and change their cultural climate? Hmm.
Jason Mattel is a professor of film and media culture at Middlebury College. His piece at TheAtlantic.com is called Why Netflix Doesn't Release Its Ratings. Here's a hint, because they don't have to. Jason, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, which I am just going to go ahead and declare it, even though it's only Tuesday. It's this week's sign the apocalypse is upon us. The BBC is reporting that MasterCard has come up with a new way to keep our transactions secure. Forget passwords. They are so passe. Selfies are the new thing for authenticating transactions. You download an app. It scans your face. It asks you to blink so that it knows you're not using a picture. And boom, you're validated in more ways than one, I guess. All done. The Dow off 188 points today, about 1.1%. The NASDAQ down 67 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500, 24 points lower, 1.25% there. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.